Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, sharing insights into health and healing, living a longer, more vital life, but also examining many of the issues that the mainstream or alternative media is simply not providing us. Today, we're going to talk about those who need an alternative to Prozac. We have one, and a good one. How, from Harvard School of Public Health, we learned that eating more fruits and vegetables is associated with a substantial weight loss, which a lot of people need. How exercise reduces suicide by 23%, and probiotics reverse cow milk allergies by changing gut bacteria in infants, and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to take a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well as the TTIP and how they're going to change the local rules against hazardous chemicals. That is one of their strategies. Sarah Lazar from Common Dreams will share that insight. Also, what mega blazes tell us about the fiery future of climate change? Many people are not aware that this was the hottest year on record, but also we had the worst fires recorded in human history. We have over 10 million acres burned. That's a huge amount of land. And yet most people, if they live outside of the burn areas, are not aware of it. So Tim Dickinson from Rolling Stone shares some insights about what's happening up in Olympia and the Pacific Northwest. Now, the last time I was up there, it was rainy. I was on a tour for a book and on the environment, and I noticed that every day for about 5 days, it was raining, light or misty, but then you go into the woods for these wonderful runs and bike rides, and they have long trails, and it was always almost tropical. It was not cold, wasn't hot, but it was very humid. That's changing, radically changing. And because it's changing, it provides an incredible environment for fire. So I'll share that with you today. Also, on this past Sunday, I was approached by a gentleman on the street wanting me to say something about Bernie Sanders. He said, "You're going to give a talk?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Why don't you promote Bernie Sanders?" And I said, "Which part?" He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Do you want me to talk about how he once was a socialist, isn't today, but uses that idea to inspire a lot of younger people and out-of-work people and people afraid about their finances? But I could talk about the Bernie Sanders supporting every single military incursion into Libya, into Iraq, into Afghanistan, the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, supporting Israel, giving unlimited amounts of money and arms to Israel, and Israel then using that to challenge the Palestinian population and Gaza and the West Bank. Which of those do you want me to talk about?" And I said, "If you want to talk with someone who really represents a socialist position, listen to what Ralph Nader has to say." And I used over 70% of my time letting people know why one of the greatest humanitarians and one of the greatest activists, if not the greatest activist, certainly all the others before them, did not achieve what he did. Not Carrie Nation, not Susan B. Anthony, not Mother Jones, but Ralph Nader did. We wouldn't have an Environmental Protection Agency. We wouldn't have a Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. We wouldn't have all those 243 pieces of legislation without him, and he was not an elected official. But he has never wavered from his principles. So today, I will share, as a point of view of a socialist, Chris Hedges, in his own words, from Truthdig, what it means to be a socialist. Now, I don't advocate any ism. I don't advocate socialism, Judaism. I just advocate finding the truth within your own life and honoring it at the highest level with moral integrity. That's it. But we need another voice to share that particular point of view. We have a lot of voices, lots, and very articulate voices on capitalism and free market entrepreneurialism and neoglobalism and corporatism. Some outstanding speakers. But Bernie Sanders is not a challenge to them because he is, in many ways, supporting many of them. Chris Hedges doesn't support any of that. So I'll share Chris Hedges' view. And I only wish Chris were there to share his point of view. Also today, I'll have a guest in the second part of our program. Her name is Anne. Her last name, Anonymous, because she's going to tell us about child trafficking and kidnapping scams by the state of Kentucky's child service departments. I believe that it's time that we had a full and open discussion on parents' rights not to vaccinate their children or to give them chemotherapy if that parent has done their homework and finds that there is no proof that that particular approach would help the child, even cause harm to the child. And if you doubt me, come one day to Sloan Kettering's Pediatric Cancer Ward and look at all those children. And then 2 years from now, see how many of them have died using only the state-of-art cancer therapy. Now, this goes beyond the medical protection. This goes beyond profiteering by stealing children by the state. You have not heard this before. This is an exclusive interview. It will be revealing. Also today, I'll talk about the runaway warming and the richest nations spending $200 billion a year. Great. Nope. They're backing fossil fuels. Well, that's not good. No, it's not. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We have a country filled with people who are having problems each day with emotional balance. They frequently feel insecure. They feel fearful that they're losing their job or relationship or their health, or maybe they've lost their health. I can tell you, counseling an awful lot of people in my life, that when a person faces a serious and potentially fatal disease, it comes up multiple times in a day. And so part of how you help people is getting them to focus not on the disease, but on the wellness, on the healing model. We have 25% of all women in the United States between the ages of 25 and 45 who are taking an anti-anxiety medication. You would think then that we'd focus some attention upon why are so many millions of women, actually tens of millions of women, why are they so anxious? Shouldn't that be where we begin our journey of helping them? But we don't. We go to the end of that process, to the symptoms. And therefore, we give them Prozac. In my personal opinion, one of the most dangerous drugs ever created that should be used by no one at any time. However, it's the number one drug for those who suffer from anxiety. Here is an alternative. It is 5-HTP. That stands for 5-hydroxy, high, H-Y-D, droxy, R-O-X-Y, tryptophan, T-R-Y-P-T-O-P-H-A-N, hydroxytryptophan. Now, most people think of serotonin, which is 5-HT, one of the most important brain neurotransmitters, and it is. But L-tryptophan is first converted to 5-HTP in nerve cells by vitamin B3-dependent enzyme. And then 5-HTP is converted to 5-HT by vitamin B6-dependent enzyme. Yet thanks to modern science, we can now take a preformed 5-HTP, that means it goes directly into the body and directly to help you, and the 5-HTP passes through the blood-brain barrier into the brain far more easily than tryptophan, and getting tryptophan through the blood-brain barrier is the main bottleneck, which in many people leads to inadequate brain serotonin levels. Also, 5-hydroxytryptophan is very important for your brain. And so this is why we should be using it. Now, we know that serotonin, which is so important for stabilizing your mood, it is the key brain neurotransmitter, meaning serotonin helps your mood. It's anti-anxiety. It's an antidepressant. It controls impulses. It inhibits aggression. It controls obsessive-compulsive disorders. It helps control pain, and it provides deeper sleep. That's what this one single nutrient, serotonin, does. Serotonin is also the precursor of our pineal gland's production of melatonin. And human clinical studies show that 5-HTP is a far more efficient increaser of brain serotonin than L-tryptophan. And furthermore, 5-HTP has been compared to tryptophan in human studies, and it's more successful as an antidepressant. And so, therefore, HTP, 5-HTP, is the ultimate antidepressant because it increases brain dopamine and neuroadrenaline activity. And these are two key mood and alertness regulating neurotransmitters. And when tyrosine, the amino acid precursor of brain dopamine and neuroadrenaline, is given along with 5-HTP, the effect is even more powerful. So what am I saying here in lay language? I'm saying in a society that has made the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor, the SSRI drugs, such a powerful gold standard for managing the serotonin deficient syndrome using Prozac, that it is worth looking at a natural, non-toxic, but far more effective way of balancing your brain chemistry. And this is when you stop the one search and you look at the natural search. So that's what it is. And there's lots of studies to prove this. Now, eating more fruits and vegetables can help you lose weight. This is from Harvard School of Public Health, published in PLOS Medicine. Quote, increased consumption of fruits and non-starchy vegetables is inversely associated with weight change. The longitudinal study conducted by Monica Brody of Harvard and the Chan School of Public Health in Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, shows differences by type of fruit or vegetable, suggesting the characteristics of these foods influence the strength of their association with weight change. They did this study over 24 years with 133,468 nurses and physicians. And they found that the more these fruits you eat and vegetables, the more you're going to lose weight and be at a healthy advantage, live a longer life. That's important. And I know a lot of you are increasing your fruits and vegetables and juicing. Also from the University of Vermont, it found that when they took a look at 13,593 high school students and they looked at the exercising that was done, those who exercised 4 or 5 days a week had a 23% reduction in suicidal ideation, meaning where you think about suicide, or actual attempted suicide. So that's a big deal. We could be saving a lot of lives if we were to merely have a regular exercise program for school children every day. And this was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. So get the kids out exercising. And parents, what a good way to start the day is to get up an hour early. Get your kids out of bed, and all of you go for a jog, power walk, or power biking. Power biking simply means that you put it in the high gear, which is the greatest resistance, so that you really have to force those leg muscles to move. So any exercise you can do 5 days a week, you lower your kids' risk of suicide. Also, from the University of Chicago Medical Center, published in the ISME journal, they found that the gut bacteria of infants who developed tolerance to cow's milk after treatment with probiotic formulas. And so that is important because not everyone will breastfeed, which is the ideal, and that's what we should be doing. Some will use formulas, some will use cow's milk, which is very bad, but at least if you're giving the probiotics, based upon this study, you can help lessen allergies from the cow's milk. So if children are going to have cow's milk, and I would prefer they did not, what they're really having the problem with is the casein, C-A-S-E-I-N. Always look that for on a label, because it may say lactose-free, but still have casein, which comes from dairy. It has to say dairy-free. In fact, there's a cheese out there for vegans, and it says vegetarian, but it doesn't say vegan. Some people are confused by that. So just make sure it has no casein in it. And make sure your kid is getting healthy probiotics. And one way to give your kid healthy probiotics is give them some sauerkraut or some cabbage juice. And finally, if you want to supercharge your dreams, from the University of Adelaide in Australia, take the B complex. This was a major study, and they found that, quote, early research suggests taking vitamin B6 may be able to make dreams more vivid, colorful, emotional, and bizarre. And other B vitamins may also help people to remember their dreams or have lucid dreams. So B6, B1, B2, B12, and I would say it 15 milligrams. And these people found it made a difference in only 10 days. So that will help you. And chocolate boosts cognitive motor skills, from Clarkson University. This was published in a major journal, and it showed that by having the high chocolate, meaning 70 to 85%, it can help your brain. So, and it's not a lot, but it can make a difference. And by the way, vitamin D may help prevent diabetes and heart disease. Washington University School of Medicine published in Peer Journal Cell Reports, quote, a study suggested vitamin D deficiency is linked more closely to diabetes than obesity. Researchers found a direct correlation between low, meaning inadequate vitamin D levels, and glucose metabolism. And this also prevented, when you took enough of it, it helped prevent type 2 diabetes and atherosclerosis. So make sure you're getting your vitamin D every day, and you can help prevent heart disease and lessen your risk of diabetes. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now I want to look at some other issues, including the environmental segment. This is from Rolling Stone. I'll only give a small part of it, but it'll give you an idea. It's by Tim Dickinson, and it says, what megablazes tell us about the fiery future of climate change. Quote, in May of this year, the nearly unthinkable happened in the Pacific Northwest. That means he's talking about Vancouver, Portland, Seattle, Tacoma, that area. The rainforest of Olympic Peninsula, one of the wettest places on the continent, caught fire. By August, an inferno was stirring in the forest east of the Cascades. A wind-whipped blaze near the mountain of Twisp, Washington, quote, became a hailstorm, to quote the local sheriff, claiming the lives of three Forest Service fire scouts. That blaze soon exploded into the worst wildfire in the state history, charring more than 300,000 acres and destroying dozens of homes. As they raged, the wildfires in eastern Oregon and Washington devoured an area nearly the size of Delaware. The states called up more than 1,000 members of their National Guards, and the Army mobilized 200 active duty troops to the fire lines. 10 Black Hawk helicopters and 4 C-130 Hercules aircraft deployed to help fire fighting from the skies. In fact, they had, according to the governor, calling a blaze an unprecedented cataclysm. Washington even deputized citizen volunteers to fight the fires. They were joined by professional crews from as far away as Australia and New Zealand. This is the present and the future, of climate change. Our overheated world is amplifying drought and making megafire commonplace. This is happening even in the soggy Pacific Northwest, which has been hard hit by what's been dubbed a wet drought. Despite near normal precipitation, warm winter temperatures brought rain instead of snow to the region's mountains. What little snow did hit the ground then melted early, leaving the Northwest dry and ready to burn in the heat of summer. The national data is as clear as it is troubling. Quote, climate change has led to fire seasons that are now on average 78 days longer than in 1970, according to the Forest Service report. In the past three decades, the annual area claimed by fire has doubled, and it's going to double again. The human imprint on the bone-dry conditions that lead to fire is real and now measurable. According to a major new study by scientists at Columbia University and NASA, man-made warming is increasing atmospheric evaporation, drawing water out of western soil, shrubs, and trees. In California alone, the epic drought is up to 25% more severe than it would have been absent climate change. And this impact doesn't respect state borders. The study's lead author, Columbia scientist Park Williams, tells Rolling Stone, quote, there's the same effect in the Pacific Northwest. Standing near fire lines in late August, Inslee vowed to extinguish the blazes in the state, but the governor also called on Americans to confront an enemy fiercer, more insidious than fire itself. He declared, we've got to attack this at its source, carbon pollution. The fiery future is upon us. Pervasive drought and record temperatures, July was the warmest month ever physically recorded on the planet Earth, have turned forests from Fresno to Fairbanks into tinderboxes. In Alaska, more than 5 million acres burned, surpassing the 10-year average for the entire country. Within months left in the fire season, the blazes of 2015 have already scorched more than 8 million acres, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, a record pace likely to top the 9.8 million acres that burned in 2006. Quote, some of these fires that are in these forested areas could burn until it snows. So, and it's a long article, but that just gives you an idea that areas we thought were good to live in because of great weather, lots of water, nice soil, nice people, is now no longer the case. Plus, it's on an earthquake fault line, not the San Andreas, far worse than the San Andreas, and it's way past time for that to break when those shelves overlap. The last time that shelf overlapped was 300 years ago, and the average cycle is 170 years, and it sent a 600-foot tsunami across the ocean hitting Japan. So there's a lot of reasons why some places in America are more preferable to live, more hospitable, and more sustainable than others. And also, concerning the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this is from Common Dreams, Sarah Lazar. Quote, a new report finds that the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership poses a threat to state regulators against hazardous pesticides, products, and fracking chemicals. The mammoth Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, under secret negotiation between the United States and European Union, is poised to slash the power of local governments to regulate toxins, from pesticides to fracking chemicals, the Center for International Environmental Law warned in a report released yesterday. Beyond the regulatory cooperation chapter, little else is known about the content of the closed-door negotiations over what is set to be the largest bilateral trade deal in history. The chapter contents, warns the group, highlight the direct threat that this treaty poses to the public health and environment protections on the U.S. state level. This is especially troublesome, the report argues, because federal regulators under the Toxic Substance Control Act have proven, quote, egregiously ineffective and could be even further eroded thanks to the influence of the chemical industry in Congress. The bottom line is, if you're trying to make the U.S. compatible with the international standard and you have minimal federal regulations on the U.S. side and you have states that go beyond that, the provisions will be used to attack state chemical and pesticide regulations. In simple lay language, it means if your state is good to live in because they care enough about you to protect you from chemicals, this would wipe away those protections. I'm Gary Nall. Let's take a brief music break. And for the next week, we're going to remember the 1950s. Then we'll be back. Have a lot more to share with you. Please stay with us.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through.
I'd like to welcome all of our listeners from all over the world. By the way, good news for those of you, and I know there are many of you, who are sharing articles and documentaries like Seeds of Death about the dangers of GMOs. As of today, Austria and Italy are celebrating bans on GM crops with European Union opt-out. The Australian Minister of Health and a number of Italian ministers have confirmed that both countries are officially requesting an opt-out from growing the 8 varieties of GM maize permitted or set to be permitted at the European Union level. Thus, there will be now a full-blown ban on GM crops in both countries under the new European Union regulations. Quote, Austria has made use of the newly created European Union opt-out rules for the authorization of genetically modified crops. Good for them. And on Monday, Northern Ireland also joined the massive wave of European Union countries that have decided to ban the cultivation of GM crops under new European Union regulations that were passed earlier in 2015. Northern Ireland and Lithuania have followed France, who announced their decision last week, and also Greece and Latvia is asking for an opt-out from growing GM crops. Germany and Scotland have also made it clear they will follow the same path. German agricultural minister Christian Schmidt informed German states in August of his intention to use a new European Union law passed in March to ban the use of genetically modified crops. So we are making a difference. Never assume that the emails of articles and documentaries and white paper reports won't help. They all make a difference. I'm going to share some thoughts now on a challenge between Bernie Sanders as an avowed socialist and Chris Hedges as a socialist. They both claim to be socialists. The public has had a chance to hear from Bernie Sanders, and on many issues, I think Bernie's on the right side of history and the right side of the issues, but not on foreign policy, not on the militarization of American police, not on our Justice Department, not on many of the issues that we find trouble with our governments. So here's what Chris Hedges has to say on this. So this is Chris Hedges. These are his words. This is his position. You could accept or reject, but at least now you'll see a difference in why I would not vote for Bernie Sanders, but I would look for third-party candidates that represent the true values of the American people. Quote, we live in a revolutionary moment. The disastrous economic and political experiment that attempted to organize human behavior around the dictates of a global marketplace have failed. The promised posterity that was to have raised the living standards of workers through trickle-down economics has been exposed as a lie. A tiny global oligarchy has amassed obscene wealth while the engine of unfettered corporate capitalism plunders resources, exploits cheap, unorganized labor, and creates pliable, corrupt governments that abandon the common good to serve corporate profit. history has amply demonstrated the seizure of power by a tiny cabal, whether a political party or a clique of oligarchs, leads to despotism. Governments that cater exclusively to a narrow interest group and redirect the machinery of state to furthering the interests of that group are no longer capable of responding rationally in times of crisis. Blindly serving their masters, they acquiesce to the looting of state treasuries to bail out corrupt financial houses and banks while ignoring chronic unemployment and underemployment, along with stagnant or declining wages, crippling debt peonage, a collapsing infrastructure, and the millions left destitute and often homeless by deceptive mortgages and foreclosures. A bankrupt liberal class holding up values it does nothing to defend discredits itself as well as the purported liberal values of a civil democracy as it is swept aside, along with those values. In this moment, a political, economic, or natural disaster, in short, a crisis, will ignite unrest, lead to instability, and see the state carrying out draconian forms of repression to maintain order. This is what lies ahead. We will, as Frederick Engels wrote, make a transition either to socialism or barbarianism. If we do not dismantle global capitalism, we will descend into Hobbesianism. Chaos of failed states, mass migrations, which we already are witnessing, and endless war. Populations, especially in the global south, will endure misery and high mortality rates caused by collapsing ecosystems and infrastructures on a scale not seen since perhaps the Black Plague. There can be no accommodation with global capitalism. We will overthrow this system or be crushed by it. And at this moment of crisis, we need to remind ourselves what being a socialist means and what it does not mean. First and foremost, all socialists are unequivocal anti-militarist, anti-imperialist. They understand that there is no genuine social, political, economic, or cultural reform as long as the militarist and their corporatist allies in the war industry continue to loot and pillage the state budget, leaving the poor to go hungry, working men and women in distress, and the infrastructure to collapse and social services to be slashed in the name of austerity. The psychosis of permanent war, which infected the body politic after World War I with the internal and external war on communism, and which today has mutated into the war on terror, is used by the state to strip us of our civil liberties, redirect our resources to the war machine, and criminalize democratic dissent. We have squandered trillions of dollars and resources in endless and futile wars from Vietnam to the Middle East at a time of ecological and fiscal crisis. The folly of endless war is one of the signs of a dying civilization. One F-22 Raptor fighter plane costs $350 million. We have 187 of them. One Tomahawk cruise missile costs $1.4 million. We fired 161 of them when we attacked Libya. This missile attack on Libya alone cost us $250 million. We spend an estimated $1.7 trillion a year on war, far more than the official 54% of discretionary spending, or roughly $600 billion. If we don't break the back of the war machine, profound change will be impossible. And then we have to look at the world in which we live today. The human cost has been horrendous. Over 1 million dead in Iraq. Millions more are displaced or are refugees. Iraq will never be reconstituted as a unified state, and it was our war industry that created the mess. We attacked a country that did not threaten us and had no intention of threatening its neighbors, and destroyed one of the most modern infrastructures in the Middle East. We brought not only terror and death, including the Shiite death squads we armed and trained, but power outages, food shortages, and the collapse of basic services. From garbage collection to sewer and water treatment, we dismantled Iraq's institutions, disbanded its security forces, threw its health services into crisis, and engineered massive poverty and unemployment. And out of the chaos rose insurgents, gangsters, kidnapping rings, jihadists, and rogues paramilitary groups, including our hired mercenaries like, for example, the ISIS group. Foreign battlefields are laboratories for the architects of industrial slaughter. They perfect the tools of control and annihilation on the demonized and the destitute. But these tools eventually make their way back to the heart of empire, as the corporatists and the militarists disemboweled the nation, rendering our manufacturing centers boarded up wastelands and tossing our citizens into poverty and despair. The methods of subjugation familiar to those on the outer reaches migrate back to us. Wholesale surveillance, indiscriminate use of lethal force in the streets of our cities against unarmed civilians, a stripping away of our civil liberties, a dysfunctional court system, drones, arbitrary arrest, detention, and mass incarceration. The tyranny empire imposes on others reminds us it finally imposes on itself. Those who kill in our name abroad soon kill in our name at home. Democracy is snuffed out. As the German socialist Karl Liebknecht stated during the First World War, the main enemy is at home. We will destroy the engines of endless war and shut down the war profiteers, or we will become the next victims. Indeed, many in our marginal communities already are its victims. You cannot be a socialist and an imperialist. You cannot, as Bernie Sanders has done, support the Obama administration's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen, and be a socialist. You cannot, as Sanders has done, vote for every military appropriations bill, including every bill and every resolution that empowers and sanctions Israel to carry out its slow-motion genocide of the Palestinian people, and be a socialist. You cannot laud, as Sanders has done, military contractors because they bring jobs to your state. Sanders may have the rhetoric of inequality down, but he is a full-blown member of the Democratic caucus, which kneels before the war industry and their lobbyists. And no genuine grassroots movement will ever be born within the bowels of the Democratic Party establishment, which is currently attempting to shut down Sanders to make sure its anointed candidate is the nominee. No elected official dares to challenge any weapon systems, no matter how costly or redundant. And Sanders, who votes with the Democrats 98% of the time, steers clear of confronting the master of war. Sanders, of course, like all elected officials, profits from this Faustian pact. The Vermont Democratic Party leadership, in return for his deference, has not supported any candidate to run against Sanders since 1990. Sanders endorses Democratic candidates no matter how much they push neoliberalism down our throats, including Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And Sanders carrying water for the Democrats is the primary obstacle to the building of a third party in Vermont. There's a reason no establishment politician, including Sanders, dare says a word against the war machine. If you do, you'll end up like Ralph Nader, tossed into the political wilderness. Nader was not afraid to speak this truth. And it is in the wilderness, I'm afraid, that real socialists must be for the moment. Socialists understand that if we do not dismantle the war machine, nothing, absolutely nothing, will change. Indeed, things will only get worse. And so, in conclusion, it is only when it is impossible to profit from war that wars will be dramatically curtailed, if not stopped. No one sitting in the boardroom of General Dynamics is hoping peace breaks out in the Middle East. No one in the Pentagon, especially the generals who build their careers by fighting and managing wars, prays for a cessation of conflict. War, wrapped in the cant of nationalism and the euphoria that comes with the giddy celebration of power and violence, is used by ruling elites to thwart and destroy the aspirations of working men and women and distract us from our disempowerment. Who was it? It was Eugene Debs who said, "Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder, and that is war in a nutshell." Wars, as Randolph Bourne wrote, is the health of the state. What that means? It means it allows the state to accrue to itself power and resources that in peacetime a citizenry would never permit. And that is why the war state, like one that we live in, has to make certain that we are always afraid. Constant violence by the war machine, we are assured, will alone make us safe. Any attempt to rein in spending or expanding power will profit the enemy. It was the militarists and the capitalists that at the end of World War II conspired to roll back the gains made by working men and women under the New Deal. They used the rhetoric of the Cold War to cement into place an economy geared towards total war, even in peacetime. This permitted the arms industry to continue to make weapons with guaranteed profits from the state and permitted the generals to continue to preside over their fiefdoms. And so it was, the incestuous relationship between the corporatists and the militarists. See, retired generals and officers offered lucrative jobs in the war industry. The manufacturing of weapons systems and the waging of war today is the chief activity of the state. It is no longer one among other means of advancing the national interest. It has become the sole national interest. These corporatist militarists are the enemies of socialists. They bankrolled and promoted movements nearly a 20th century that call for reforms within these structures of capitalism that spoke to the language of the politics of productivism. They eschewed the language of class conflict and talked only about economic growth in a partnership with the capitalist class. The NAACP, for example, was formed to lure African Americans away from the Communist Party. The AFL-CIO was fed CIA money to help crush and supplant radical unions abroad and at home. The AFL-CIO, like the NAACP, is today a victim of its own corruption and bureaucratic senility. Its bloated leadership pulls down huge salaries as its dwindling rank and file is stripped of benefits and protections. The capitalists no longer need what they once called responsible unionism, which meant pliable unionism. And once the capitalists and the militarists killed off the radical movements and unions, they finished off the dupes who had helped them to do it. And that is why less than 12% of our country's workforce is unionized and why we have such vast income disparities and chronic unemployment and underemployment. Surplus labor, desperate for work and unwilling to challenge the bosses to retain a job, is the bulwark of capitalism. The New Deal, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a charter member of the oligarchical class, said, save capitalism, was put in place because socialists were strong and a serious threat. The oligarchs understood that with the breakdown of capitalism, something I expect we'll again witness in our lifetimes, there was a real possibility of a socialist revolution. They were terrified they would lose their wealth and power. Roosevelt, writing to a friend in 1930, said, quote, no question in my mind that it is time for the country to become fairly radical for at least one generation. History shows that where this occurs occasionally, nations are saved from revolution, end quote. In other words, Roosevelt went to his fellow oligarchs and said, hand over some of your money or we will lose all of that money in a revolution. And his fellow capitalists complied, and that is how the government created 15 million jobs, Social Security, unemployment benefits, and public works projects. The capitalists did not do this because the suffering of the masses moved them. They did it because they were scared, and they were scared of radicals and socialists. As George Bernard Shaw got it right in his play Major Barbara, quote, the greatest crime is poverty. It is the crime every socialist is dedicated to eradicating. All the other crimes are virtues beside it. All the other dishonors are chivalry itself by comparison. Poverty blights whole cities, spreads horrible pestilences, strikes dead the very souls of all who come within it, sight, sound, and smell of it. What you call crime is nothing. A murder here, a theft there, a blow now, and a curse then. What do they matter? They are only the accidents and illnesses of life. There are not 50 genuine professional criminals in London, but there are millions of poor people, abject people, dirty people, ill-fed people, ill-clothed people. They poison us morally and physically. They kill the happiness of society. They force us to do away with our own liberties and to organize unnatural cruelties for fear they should rise against us and drag us down into their abyss. Only fools fear crime. We all fear poverty. And that's just some of the thoughts from Chris Hedges. Now let us go to our guest standing by and say hello to Ann. Nice to have you with us today, Ann.
Hi, thank you.
And we have on, you are a leading investigative reporter for the Health Impact News and medicalkidnap.com in Texas. You've been researching Kentucky's legalized child kidnapping and trafficking through its child protection services and the profiteering behind this racket. And we have covered recent cases of child kidnapping by various states' child protection services before, but most of these were for strictly medical conditions the children had, in which the parents challenged the medical physician's treatments or diagnosis and parents wanted second opinions, or for parents who refused vaccines and had their children taken away. But we haven't heard before of state involved child kidnapping as a profit-generating activity, except in your recent investigation of what is happening in Kentucky. The severity of this has made the FBI conduct an investigation. It's called Kentucky the Most Corrupt State in the Country. And there are charges and apparently evidence that the state's child services are running an adoption and foster care system that is motivated by financial gains and leading to false allegations against parents and violates the system's own statutes to reunify children with their parents. So I appreciate you sharing how the scam works and what have been some of the most disturbing stories you have heard from parents who have had their children taken away and what determines a child is a adoptable form of child that is ruled a non-adoptable child. Take us through this story.
Okay, well, correct. When you said medical kidnap mainly focuses on stories where children have been removed because maybe parents are seeking a second opinion or something like that. We also have focused on the whole Title IV funds and the CPS being a for-profit organization. So every state actually receives these funds. Kentucky's no different in that sense. However, we have just gotten a lot of stories from Kentucky, a lot of parents contacting us, and also a lot of local news media has covered the corruption in Kentucky, going as far back as when John Bull was an investigative reporter. And he did some really great videos back in 2006 and 2007, well, news reports that we've incorporated into many of our stories on Kentucky. It goes back into a lot of the history of the CPS corruption, but the organization in Kentucky is called DCBS, which is the Department of Community-Based Services, and just how corrupt that system is. You know, mainly when you've got a system that is for profit, that basically exists to receive these Title IV-E funds from the federal government, you've got a self-perpetuating organization that has to keep taking children from families in order to keep their system going. And so, you know, they're looking for child abuse and child neglect and things like that so that they can, you know, justify their own existence and keep this money funneling in, you know, which is profiting, you know, the judges, the family court judges, the GALs, the court-appointed attorneys, the social workers, supervisors, medical doctors, everyone involved in this system is profiting on these federal funds. So, you know, to kind of go over a little bit of the most recent story, one of the things that really struck me was the story of the young mother in Kentucky who, she got one of her children back. They'd been in foster care for 3 years. She got one back. And basically she was told by DCBS she got that one back because he was unadoptable. And the young daughter who was a little over three by the time the termination for parental rights came about, she was definitely adoptable. And that's, they gave her a bargain. They basically said, we will let you have your son back because he's unadoptable if you voluntarily, quote unquote, sign over your daughter for adoption. And to me, that's just a really horrific choice that any mother would be presented with. I mean, it was either that or lose both your children. And rather than let her son just go into a group home or, you know, just stay languishing from foster home to foster home, she, you know, did take that choice offered to her, which begs the question, if CPS is really an organization that is out to protect children from parents who are not, you know, capable or worthy or whatever of caring for their own children, why would you give one back then? So I think that story is really shows that it's not about whether or not that mother could care for her children. It was about whether or not those children were adoptable commodities that could be just moved from her home into a different home, and they could make money off of that transfer of that
commodity. How much money do they make?
Well, you know, it's different from state to state, and that is something that I am just really learning about. We have covered a story about CPS being a multi-billion dollar industry, nationwide. Now, how much each state gets and how much foster families, the foster families are kind of at the bottom of the totem pole. They make the least amount. But the states, we have heard numbers averaging around $6,000 a month per child. They can go even higher if it's a special needs child.
Per month,
from the moment they take them into foster care, the state starts getting that money. And
here's
then they get an adoption bonus on top of that.
Here's what we have to understand. There are some parents in the United States, due to the circumstances of the parents, who are not able to properly and adequately and responsibly and lovingly take care of their children, or they're abusive, in which case then the state services should intervene. I'm only referring to those cases where clearly the child was in a good home, the parents were fully capable of taking care of the child, the state intervened irrespective and took the child away. Do you have cases like that?
Well, exactly. A lot of the cases, the cases that we're reporting on, are allegedly those types of cases where there wasn't, in most cases, not even charges pressed against the family. It's all, hearsay. And basically, one of the major problems with CPS is that they try these cases in family court. So there's no due process of law. Parents are basically guilty until proven innocent. Anonymous calls are allowed, so there's hearsay evidence. And they work on the lowest level of evidence, basically preponderance of evidence, or just basically a social worker's opinion that a family is not caring for their children adequately. So, these types of situations is what really makes CPS and family court just an egregious violation of constitutional rights, parental rights, and things like that. So, yes, many of the stories that we write about fall into, that situation. And not only that, but in this most recent story on Kentucky, we covered some situations or some stories that were also exposed in the local media in Kentucky about social workers who are coming out and complaining about the system in Kentucky, complaining about the caseloads, having too many caseloads, having just way too much work to be able to adequately do a good job, And when these social workers complain, it seems like CPS retaliates against them as well. There's social workers, who felt like they were being punished for, doing their job correctly and really trying to look out for the welfare of a child that they thought was in danger, or social workers who maybe questioned CPS and then, they're facing termination of their job, even a former court-appointed attorney. She's currently suing CPS in Kentucky, just saying that when she started complaining about, caseloads being too high and, things like that, that they terminated her. So it just seems like within the system itself in Kentucky, there's allegedly a lot of corruption just going on. And when the people who are in the know, the social workers themselves, start to speak out about it, they even get retaliation. So that just really makes for a system that it's not really a good system, not really looking out for the benefit of the children.
Let me put this in some perspective. what you're telling us is that Child Protection Services in Kentucky has become a legalized form of child trafficking for profit. And all you have to do is follow the profit trail. Who financially profits from it? Where does the money come from? And you've given us some of that. And what are some of the questionable charges Child Services will use to confiscate children?
There's lots of different charges. Some of the stories we've read and some of the ones that John Bowl undid in his investigation was, you know, maybe CPS comes in your home and just determines your house is too dirty. Maybe you've got a sink full of dishes or unfolded laundry on your sofa. You know, anything that any typical family would have at any point in a given day, if they just happen to pop in at a time when you're in the middle of house cleaning, they may decide that, you know, you're not a good parent. So, you know, just things like that. In one of the recent cases that we reported on, there a lot of times they're just false allegations. You know, the parents claim that these anonymous calls that people make can be completely made up. In one case of the E-Town couple, they actually had a downstairs neighbor who was a social worker, and unbeknownst to them, was making false anonymous calls. And they ended up having to, you know, work six different case plans and go through drug testing and do all of this because you're basically guilty as soon as that anonymous call comes in. You're guilty, and you have to prove your innocence. And finally, this couple was able to work with the local law enforcement, and they went out of town one weekend because they knew, okay, we're probably going to start getting some calls this weekend. Let's go out of town. And the police were in on it. And when the calls started coming in, they went to investigate. Of course, that couple was gone. And so they knew that these calls were completely false allegations. I mean, there were things like the couple was dangling their child out over a balcony or throwing their child against a wall. Just really outrageous claims. And the people weren't even home. So the police were able to do an investigation, and then they arrested the downstairs neighbor who happened to be a Kentucky social worker making these calls, allegedly because she said her neighbors, her upstairs neighbors were too loud. So, you know, when people can make claims anonymously and destroy a family, and then that family has to start proving their innocence, we have a system that's just really backwards.
We're out of time, but it would appear the Kentucky system is rigged, since retaliation is taken against social workers who blow the whistle or speak out against what is going on. And we know the story of Corey and April, who were being harassed by anonymous calls to the police regarding child abuse, which the police consistently found were unwarranted when they arrived at the family's home. And this is happening. Plus, there's a profit in it, so people are making money. And there was recently a judge, two judges in Pennsylvania, that were found to have sent thousands of young kids, off to prison for long sentences because they were receiving cash kickbacks. So this entire system of child services in every state needs to be investigated, needs to have outside independent review, and those responsible for this should be brought to justice. We're out of time. Thank you very much, Ann, for sharing these with us. And that was a special report on what's happening all over America. Child services, sometimes doing the right thing, but often having the power to do the wrong thing. And when there's profit money involved, frequently that can be a motivating factor to do the wrong thing. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.